The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good afternoon, everyone. We're going to start. We have, you know, great panelists, and I want to maximize the full time that we're here, and I'm sure people will be flowing in. My name is Shyam Tolihak, and I'll be facilitating the session, and I'll introduce our panelists in just a little bit. And their bios are, their fuller bios are in the program. So the title of the session is Moving from the Margins, and which means this is a session about how to assimilate into America and how to become successful and rich in 10 points. Okay, tell Deepak, because I started on time.
Oh, yeah, she
okay. All right, it's the cookies.
Mm-hmm. People are distracted by the cookies.
I'll do my movie routine to keep you
human. I do too.
So like I was saying, I thought this was all about simulation and how to become wealthy and successful, and how me as a Bangladeshi can become Indian in like.
We don't want you to do that.
Well, I thought this was about this panel about moving from the margins. Bisexual to straight and all those different ways. But that is, if you're for that session, this is not that session. Right about now, like, there's going to be that sort of but we are waiting for a few minutes for folks to kind of come in. But maybe what I'll do is I want everyone to hear your bios.
That's okay.
They
can read about the bios.
If they've not moved from outside to inside,
they're never going to move from
right.
inside. Right.
Okay. So, seriously.
Maybe it's the mainstream moving to the margins.
Right.
Engage it.
Well, now you're laughing. Let's actually seriously frame the discussion, which is a very important topic. And we're going to have a conversation about who's invisible and who's on the margins. And when we talk about the margins, are issues that often get ignored within the South Asian community. And I would say also the South Asian sort of progressive activist community. And on this panel, we're going to sort of talk about some of these issues, a sort of not necessarily exhaustive list of these are the issues that get marginalized, but to give you a sort of sense of what some of those issues are, but to really focus a lot of the session on to be very practical and use some tools. Earlier in the morning, I attended a session on creating spaces on gender and sexuality, and where, again, some of these issues were addressed. And I always feel like this is sort of part two, because they began in that session to talk about how do you create spaces, to talk about issues, particularly sexuality, that often are not addressed. And so that's going to be the framing and sort of the panel. But let's talk about, debunking some of the notions about South Asians and this notion that we are a monolithic community. We're a population of more than 2.7 million, fastest growing Asian American community. We are diverse in terms of national origin, languages, economic status, religious affiliation, sexual orientation, and you name it, in all different ways. We're situated in urban areas and rural areas. We're foreign-born. We're also born in the United States. Someone said they were 1.5 born, so it came sort of more in 17, older age. We possess a wide range of immigration statuses. We have careers in different professionals as well as working class fields. And so within this diversity, it's inherently diverse, yet we do sideline some issues within our community, and we're going to talk about that. And some of the issues that we're going to talk about today are class dynamics, on how we render invisible or marginalized class issues within our community, mental health issues, how we don't talk about mental health concerns and issues within our community, as well as violence and domestic violence issues, and LGBTQ issues as well. So those are kind of the range of issues that we're going to talk about in this panel. And I hope from our question and answer session, maybe some of you can share from your organizing work areas that you've felt have been sort of marginalized in your work, and efforts in which tools you've used to kind of bring those issues to the foreground, and why you thought it was important to bring those issues forward. So we have with us a very distinguished panelists of speakers. From all the way down on the table, we have Aparna Bhattacharya. She is the executive director. She's boss lady, as I call her. The Georgia-based. It's afternoon. We have to have a little. And so please don't take my facilitation style as any way diminishing the topic. But I want us to really, you know, talk about have fun, because we should have fun. We don't have fun as activists sometimes. Georgia-based nonprofit, a director of Raksha is a Georgia-based nonprofit organization for the South Asian community. And Raksha's mission is to promote a stronger and healthier South Asian community through confidential support services, education, and advocacy. Next to me, we have Akash Kishore. Akash has served on the board of Satrang, an LGBTQ organization in Southern California, since June of 2008. And Akash has worked with several social justice organizations to build coalitions across age, class, ethnicity, gender identity, race, and sexual orientation. And I'm skipping, and in the center we have Razia Kosi. Razia is the founder of CHAI, which stands for Counselors Helping South Asians and Indians, a nonprofit organization dedicated to educating the South Asian community about mental health and wellness issues here in the in DC metro area. So during this discussion, we're going to talk about sort of three main points. What issues get marginalized, and why do they get marginalized in the South Asian community? What are best practices and innovative approaches to making sure that we can have an honest and open conversation about issues? You know, obviously there's an unstated point here, which is that these issues are important. And so they do need to be brought to the fore. And finally, how all of us can play a part in moving these issues that are on the margins to the mainstream. So just to begin, I'm going to ask each panelist to share with us briefly sort of the issue of the community they work on and why that issue becomes marginalized or sidelined.
Start with me.
Or
that should stop me in.
Well, I feel privileged to be able to even talk about domestic violence, but I also acknowledge, number one, that domestic violence, probably out of the three topics, is probably the most covered. So I know that while I'm talking about it being a marginalized issue, it is an issue that probably gets more support within the South Asian community. And there's so many South Asian domestic violence organizations, so I just want to own that and at least put it out there and recognize that. But it still is a topic that is very difficult to talk with our community overall. The thing that I always hear, and of course this is where it intersects, is like, our community, really? The educated folks? So there's definitely a lot of classes when we talk about domestic violence. They always think it's the uneducated folks who don't have money. And I always have to say, no, it's everybody in our community. Doesn't matter what. And we want to also sideline it to a certain religion or a certain region. And again, that's the constant of like it impacts in our entire community. It's always a difficult topic, and one of the things is there's a lot of denial because none of us want to admit that it can happen to us. So for that reason, it's easy to not support it, easy to not want to talk about it, and of course it's bringing up all the negative issues in our community. But I feel like it's tied in so much with the topics that we're talking about with mental health. There's the controversy of doing mental health and domestic violence, but I mean, and my philosophy has always been that you've got to heal from, nobody should have to listen to being abused, being called stupid, being called any kind of name, and not get support, because it is, I mean, if we break our arm, we go to the doctor. So if we've been hurt in any way, mentally and emotionally, why can't we get that support? And to the same thing, we don't do enough in recognizing all the ways that abuse plays out in all of our communities. So it's an area of like, while it's an area that we don't like to talk about, we also need to do a better job of integrating and making sure that it's in all of our communities and we're tying all of our issues together, which is probably, I'm jumping ahead of the game, but but that's the way that we've always felt about it. In Atlanta, and that's, I guess, the gist of it, so then we can go on and talk more.
Okay, so when I started CHAI to address mental health and wellness, and to really bring out into the open topics that were well hidden in the community. And one of the things we first started talking about in open forum was just trying to deal with the whole biculturalism. And quickly, as we were starting to talk about that, we couldn't separate some of the more deeper mental health issues. And as we started talking about depression and stress and anxiety, we couldn't then separate the issues of domestic violence, of immigration, the whole piece of coming into the country, and also hate crimes and dealing with racism and LGBTQI issues and things that are happening at multi-levels that are affecting our community and are just deeper and deeper hidden and pushed down, because it is something that you know, we've quoted the whole model minority myth, and being a little bit of a geek I am, I had to go get the source document. I'm like, you know, I've never actually read the entire source document unraveling the model minority myth. And as I'm reading this, it's quite interesting because it was a myth from the beginning. Because as I'm reading this, one of the most interesting thing comes out with interviewing some of the Asian American youth is that very quickly the class and privilege comes out in the interviews, that it is, you know, a lot of the Korean groups didn't want to associate with the Vietnamese groups and didn't want to associate with the Chinese groups, and the wealthier Korean groups who looked more Anglo didn't want to associate with the newer Korean groups who were dressing in another way. So very quickly the separation in the community was already set up as to who was, as you were kind of joking about the assimilation, but who was able to assimilate more quickly and get into a level of privilege. And I bring these things up, I think it all affects mental health, because these are the unspoken things. These are the things that we don't create a space to talk about in terms of wellness. The other approach I really like to emphasize when I go out and talking in the community is this: there's a serious mental illness component that has a medical brain disorder piece, such as schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and there's also the daily stressors that impact a person's mental health and wellness. And those are things that can lead to deeper depression, that can lead to physiological problems based upon that, such as stress. And so I when I give the materials out and I have it translated, we try to also help give a holistic sense of all these things come together. And because very largely in the community, we just have such a stigma about talking about these things, and not in a healthy way. We might yell and scream, take it out in a very negative way, but we don't create a space to safely talk about these things. And we certainly don't want to admit that things aren't going well in our family, because it'll bring too much shame to ourselves. So that's part of what we try to do in unpacking what mental health is.
Okay, and I work with Satrang, which is an organization in Southern California that works with lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, queer and questioning, South Asian, community in Southern California, and not really, that's what I call it, LGBTQIA+. Satrang has mostly been a social organization up until recently, like primarily focusing on bringing the community together around social events. A couple of years ago, we conducted a needs assessment of the community along with South Asian Network, and that's actually included on the CD that you all have, so you could have a chance to look at it later. But through that, we discovered that coming out, mental health issues, language barriers to access to healthcare, that these were all issues that were pretty important to our community members that we weren't really addressing. So in recent years, Satrang has kind of been working to shift more towards the advocacy and social justice aspect. In terms of why LGBTQIA+ issues are marginalized, I think there are a lot of different reasons, and it depends on what community we look at, right? I know I can spot a few, you know, family in the audience, and we got different reasons. I think that in large part, sexual orientation and gender identity are pretty taboo issues in our communities, whether it's a matter of like outright conservatism or homophobia, transphobia, whether it's a violent thing or whether it's more of an act of silence. It can be different ways and different cultural groups within our the broader South Asian community. But you know, I think in short, it's a matter of it being a taboo. Why that is, whether it's an issue of, you know, bringing together individualistic and collectivist communities, or whether it be an issue of outright hate versus just kind of an uneasiness, or that's a community by community issue, I think. So,
mm-hmm. Actually, wanted to highlight. There's actually a number of really good materials in the CD, and Akash just reminded. In addition to their excellent report, which everyone should really read line by line, and it's just phenomenal. I'm a big supporter of need assessments, and but there's also articles about Amid the Isolation, Finally a Friend, a Movement to Confront Abuse as an Immigrant Family, Giving Visibility. This is just some. I'm not going to list all of them. Visibility to Needs of South Asian. South Strong Report, Barriers to Seeking Counseling and Other Mental Health Services, One Big Happy Community, Class Issues in the South Asian Homes. I wanted to go back to Razia about your, you know, raising the model minority myth issue as sort of a starting point, because I think that, you know, one of the things I heard you to say is sort of, you mentioned stigma, and also that the myth was a myth to begin with. And so maybe if you can elaborate maybe in your work, mm-hmm. how that impacts your work, and, you know, how that's hurtful, the sort mm-hmm. of model minority myth.
I think people are now almost carrying the badge of, like, having a lot of stress as something that they should be almost proud of, because it means they're working hard, they're really trying to get ahead, they're trying to do all these things, and not recognizing that you need everyone functions on a little bit of stress. You know, there's pieces of us that get going, you know, we feel a little anxious or excited. There's a little piece that's a healthy piece that gets us going. However, when it becomes overwhelming, when we can't function, we raise much more anxiety, it actually causes physical problems in us, ulcers, it can cause, high blood pressure, it can cause some symptoms as well as mental symptoms where you can't function, but not even recognizing that that's not something that's a healthy state, that this whole, you know, especially among the South Asian community, wanting to be successful, and a lot of times it's defined as financial success, and really wanting to achieve a certain amount and taking on more and more, and not really slowing to look at overall holistically, is this connecting with my spiritual health, my mental health, my physical health, and all those components. I think those kind of pieces of wanting to fit some kind of ideal that really is a myth then puts people ahead. And then when you have people who may have a certain level of financial success because they have been given more educational opportunity because of the time that they came in immigration versus newer immigrants post-1985 who are not living in an area where they're having access to all of that, and then feeling the comparisons and feeling like, maybe taking a model of maybe we're doing something wrong, maybe these things aren't there, versus the system has been set up inequitably. And to look at the larger scale of what's going on can also create those pieces of it. And as people are hiding these things and taking it out either on each other in the families, as it may play out with the domestic violence, with substance abuse issues, with not even being able to, you know, you can say, well, you know, they can find this support at the mosque or the temple or the gurdwara. There's some level of support, but there's also, that's where the community is. And unfortunately, the gossiping that may happen in the community, they don't feel safe talking about it in that space. Mm-hmm. And even if you can, and even if, like, I volunteer at the Muslim Community Center. We have a free health clinic set up, and so I do the counseling there. And we're, you know, doctors, and we were seeing that this is coming up as domestic violence, as depression, as other things, and even trying to address it, then you come up with the barrier against, like, the imam saying, well, these things, you know, how are we going to do it in a different way? So mm-hmm. how to form coalitions and relationships where we're all working towards the betterment of the community, you know, they're going to look out for the spiritual health. And I think they're all connected together, and to recognize that, you know, physical, mental, and spiritual come together in this realm to create a healthier perspective and a balance in life. I think all those things kind of come together.
Same question, yeah. Domestic violence.
Right.
How does it help and how does it hurt? Mm-hmm. I think the thing is, asking for help. You can't ask for help when you're supposed to be the perfect family. Our focus on marriage from childhood really has an impact on what we perceive as successful and what we're supposed to do with our lives. And so if, you know, and I love the Sucky video because when it starts off, you hear these messages that you're given as a young girl and even as a young boy. Don't get your hair cut. Don't go out into the sun. You'll get too dark because everyone's going to marry you. And it's this emphasis from childhood about getting married. So when your marriage isn't meeting what this ideal Bollywood or our ideal whatever that we're putting out there is the image that we're supposed to be following and it's not working out, then what happens to our whole identity when this whole emphasis on marriage kind of isn't working the way we think it should? Then we blame ourselves. And then there's so much that goes on that we, and then it impacts other family members' marriages, right? Oh, your cousin's getting married, so you really can't, don't do this now. So that's the stuff that makes it really difficult for us to talk about domestic violence. And you know, the reality is, you know, none of our families are perfect. We're not the Brady Bunch, and even the Brady Bunch wasn't perfect, right? Or whatever, I guess, image that you know. I guess that's a very brought up in the U.S. Stereotype. But the reality is, you know, we need to ask for support and we need to get help. And we shouldn't be forced to be in something that's going to hurt us, something that's damaging, and we should have that support available. So the myth that we are this perfect family and that we have no problems and that we come from Gandhi and we're a peaceful folks keeps funders from giving us money to support this work. It keeps community members from thinking that we're an important community that deserves those services. I mean, I just remember being at this with a non-South Asian group. It was like the Sister of Circles, and they're doing all this work around domestic violence, and they're like, South Asian community, really? Y'all have that problem? Like, it affects every community. How can you not think it doesn't, you know, affect our community? But our mainstream South Asian community works really hard to have this wonderful image of ourselves, because if we are seen as violent, well, then they'll look at us very differently and they'll treat us differently, and then we won't get these great jobs or whatever. It's a stereotype that, you know, we're somehow not going to be as successful if we talk about the negative issues. And we've had that issue. We'd have Festival of India and we're like, let's do a workshop on domestic violence. No, we don't want to talk about those issues. This is a celebration. Why should we air our dirty laundry? And it's, what are we doing as a consequence of that? What we're doing is individuals are suffering. We're having individuals murdering their entire families. We have people dying as a result of us ignoring this, and we're not providing support to our families. And that the reality is, how much more support could we do if we started talking openly about what's really going on so we can break the isolation?
I want to just, and I actually want Akash to respond to you, but also the last point, that we're dying as a result of it. I mean, I think we talked a little bit, I mean, each of you talked a lot about sort of perception, and also wanted to maybe if you can talk a little bit about actually concretely in terms of denial of services and programs that get denied. When you don't acknowledge a problem exists, then therefore you're not going to provide services or, you know, create the safe spaces that are necessary. So maybe in your response, Akash, in terms of your work, you can talk about, you know, also concrete, like how, other than just perception, what does it mean, you know, in terms of the community, what services or programs or help is then effectively denied as a result of the invisibility?
Right. Well, I think that the model minority myth actually makes it difficult. It can make it difficult for individuals to come out to themselves in the first place in terms of that internalized stereotype. But then there's also the aspect of being able to come out into a community. All right, I'm okay with myself, and I want to be out in the community, but that just becomes impossible, or that identity just becomes completely invisibilized, if I can make that a verb right now, or whatever I just did. Because of model minority myth, so we exist. I know I exist. I know I'm real, but I can't really do much to move myself, the rest of my community forward with me in the mainstream South Asian or non South Asian LGBT community, mainstream LGBT community. I can't do much to move myself forward when. both ends are saying or have that mentality of, but you're, you know, this is what it means to be a model minority, is this, you know, getting married, and
yep.
this is the program, and how can you exist if that's not what you are? And so then in terms of real denial of services, I think it falls on every end in both of those communities, and both visibility or the services that are provided to the mainstream LGBT community. There, when we talk about language access, for example, there's virtually no translation to any South Asian languages provided, even in areas that are, you know, have pretty big South Asian populations. If they do bilingual translation, it's to Spanish, and then sometimes to Chinese languages or to, you know, different East Asian languages, but South Asian falls pretty far back on the list of priorities, and usually doesn't happen at all. So in all of the different realms that we talk about, you know, if we're talking about mental health, and we're looking for culturally appropriate and not homophobic mental health care, that's pretty hard to come by. Mm-hmm. So for, you know, all of these different issues that we're talking about.
Can I just say, yeah, I had a referral one time, and it was a young man who said, can you refer me to a Muslim therapist who's not homophobic, and I'm in the process of coming out, and I'm thinking, I need to really think about who I know, and honestly, I'm the only one I refer you to, and I can't do that. But then there becomes an obligation on my part to then work with mental health professionals who are South Asian to make them more connected and aware of their own possible issues and working with LGBTQI community, and to know who's out there. That, because if a person is, because a lot of what we do at CHI is referrals. If they call and they need a counselor, I do what's, you know, like an intake, find out what the issues are, what's been going on, and try to find someone who's going to be not just culturally appropriate linguistically, but someone that might be a right fit for that person. So a lot of times I'm also assessing, since I know a lot of the providers who are South Asian in background, who is this person going to trust in that relationship? Because that's so key. If they've gotten to the point of going into that counseling relationship, like, if it doesn't work, it's going to take so much more the next time. So to really make sure. So it is hard. And I think that's a responsibility, if I'm working with therapists, to bring these things up so that it's not just them coming, but who they're going to is. And that's the work CHI also does. We also work with the professionals on that end to ensure that they know more issues in working with the South Asian community and things that are still marginalized, that they're mm-hmm. still, even as mental health professionals, may not be well versed in or know what their own responses are in that when it's South Asian, because it actually adds another layer. They may be fine with working with somebody who is not South Asian and LGBTQI, and then all of a sudden they see someone that looks like their son or daughter. It raises something that they just need to be aware of and work through.
Did you want to add?
We've been talking a little bit more about sort of within the South Asian community, the model minority, and how that marginalizes the issue. And so I wanted to now sort of maybe, you know, at the risk of being dualistic, but for the interest of our conversation, to look outward to say in sort of the larger non-South Asian community, how have kind of issues been marginalized or not, or been receptive to or not, and if you can speak to that. I guess the anti-violence, larger community, more the mental health community, and the larger LGBT community.
Can I go first?
There's no order.
For us, of course, immigration is always marginalized. Language access is marginalized. I mean, how do you provide therapy when someone doesn't understand the words that you're saying? And, of course, I'm the annoying pest, at least in the state of Georgia, where I'm always talking about immigrant rights and language access, and they're like, Aparna, you're at it again. Because I'm the nag, and I'm the one that's always saying it. So, and my focus is not just access for the South Asian community, but it's for all immigrant communities and ensuring cultural competency across the board. So at the same time I'm the nag about, you know, South Asian issues, I'm the nag about, are you sure you've got an LGBTQ, TIQ, I love what you said, but I can't.
It's okay.
Yeah. Are you including this in the scenarios to making sure that there's access for all of our communities? I mean, in Atlanta, it's you know, for a long time it was just black and white. So to integrate anything that was not black or white was a big deal, and it's still a challenge, but we've come a long way. But it's tough because there's these stereotypes. I remember a huge foundation telling me that we're not in as much need because we're the South Asian community, and that's where, again, class comes in. We're seen as the doctors and lawyers, and so we can fund and support, you know, our issues, and we don't really need to get support from some of these foundations because we're so well off. And then there's, because we're not as, you know, like the other communities that might be in Atlanta. So, and it gets tough because then it gets competitive with the other immigrant communities, and you don't ever want to be in that position because all of our communities need support. So that's one of the things, the challenge of these perceptions of our communities. Do we really need it? And since, you know, most South Asians that they see speak English, we really don't need language access. I mean, that's not a priority for us. Instead of people seeing the, you know, kind of like the diversity of how diverse we are. So there's a lot of work to do with shelters and even recognizing the different religions, recognizing our different needs. And even the dietary restrictions. So there's a lot of work to do on many levels of really making folks see our community and meet the needs. And of course, that means a lot of times we end up doing a lot of stuff for free that those organizations should be doing for our communities, but we just need to make sure our community gets it. So I guess that's my 2 cents on that.
Thank you.
With the mainstream organizations, we've definitely been working with more. There's something near us called Foreign-Born Information Referral Network, and working with them, we actually did for International Women's Day kind of a media event where we had a couple of short videos through Breakthrough Videos shown and having community discussion about human rights as it also relates to women's rights and domestic violence, and also partnering with Domestic Violence Resource Center and in our county. And I think that there was a couple of coalitions that were built in our area. There was a South Asian coalition, an African Caribbean one, more East Asian and Hispanic, and so we were all looking at things, but taking perhaps the same topic, such as one was like cancer prevention, certain things on smoking, and then domestic violence, and how can we make it more, reach out to our other communities and work together towards bettering all our communities. So that's one of the approaches that I think has been helpful with us to do that. And even something like the food bank calling us and saying, you know, we are getting more people coming in needing to use the food bank. And so then not only needing the language information translated, but also going to like the local stores and saying, you know, can we get some bags of rice? Can we get all? Can we get to other things that are more to the dietary needs of the people there? That's going to be more useful than, you know, like SpaghettiOs or something. So just even basic things like that, I'm seeing that there's a shift in the community wanting to, seeing that the people are coming and seeing that there's a need, and then helping just be that linkage agent to making those suggestions and helping make those things happen.
I think I touched on a little bit already both, I mean, the kind of dual isolation that happens for LGBTQA South Asians in both the mainstream South Asian community and the mainstream LGBT community. I'm not going to re-say those, but I do want to say, you know, our community faces basically the same things that both of those communities face, and ways that they intersect in a different way. So, for example, if you're talking about immigration, and then you have a partner or partnership who are binational and have no way of bringing their partner over and being together because they can't get married, or they're dealing with housing discrimination and in that is a layer of homophobia, or people who are, you know, maybe undocumented workers who are trying to get work, and also who, you know, about how all of these things, they intersect with each other, basically. So Satrang, you know, is working with both of those things, but then it's also, and this is part of, I think, why our organization in particular was social for so long, and solely social for so long, is because at the end of the day is, we just need family, you know, like we need somewhere to just breathe. But we also need somewhere to make, you know, somebody who sees all of that and who's advocating So I know I didn't answer your question, but I feel like I answered it before. So
yeah, no, I think having also worked with a lot of worker organizing groups and worker centers, I mean, another area or issue oftentimes that gets not spoken about is class or within our community. And I mean, I guess in terms of what Aparna said earlier, to some extent, I felt like we've made some headway around class issues. I feel like we can come to a forum and people talk about class, and you know, still I think in terms of mental health and sexuality and gender issues, we're still kind of a little bit wavering. But still, there was a time, at least in remembering where felt very isolated personally, where people would talk about doctors and lawyers, and coming from a middle class background, and myself personally sitting in the room and saying, well, I grew up in kind of a profile that would not fit a South Asian family, mm-hmm. single mom, member of a union, working class, urban environment, and so. None of these folks look like me, and so a large part of my sort of undergraduate years, I was not necessarily involved in South Asian organizations because I didn't feel like these organizations responded to the issues that working class South Asians encountered, and I saw encountered. It's not like those people, like I said, that don't exist. They exist. It's that the community is not recognizing them, these issues, and so the I think it was a powerful statement that. And it's dying, maybe, dying as a result in the sense of denial of services and not having a family and not having safe spaces. Mm-hmm. And so these are the sort of points that I hear and heard sort of the panelists speak, and I think those are really powerful to kind of bring that to focus. I want to now kind of shift now to sort of identify, we're here, these are the issues that are important, and we have to work around these issues. I'm going to start actually with Aparna, because you did say we are mainstream now. Well, how did you get that way? Because I know that there was a time around domestic violence issues, people said, domestic violence, really? That doesn't exist. That exists in other communities, not in mm-hmm. our communities. And so in some ways, maybe the work of DV advocates might be illustrative of what strategies did you use, or do you think that the community, Raksha or the sort of other South Asian domestic violence organizations used to become
more mainstream.
Mainstream. And I have to say, I don't really like the words mainstream, margins, but I think, be patient and bear with us in terms of a term of kind of this notion that, as we're setting certain identities and certain parameters, things do get sort of excluded. And so they're used in those terms, like just for purposes of the discussion. So I just wanted to put that out there, because I know some of, I personally, what does mainstream mean? Because I always felt I am part of the mainstream. And it's like, but with that being said, I just want to sort of tell the audience, just, apologize for that. We're going to continue to use it because I don't know any other vocabulary. Continue.
How do we become it? I don't know that we're fully mainstream yet, but we definitely get a lot mm-hmm. more time than a lot of other issues get. But there are so many, there's 25 to 50 South Asian women's organizations doing domestic violence work, somewhere between there. Mm-hmm. So we're vocal, we're out there. There's a lot of, I think, again, it's our own organizing of really being vocal and being there and being able to have our voices at the table or make sure that we were at the table, reminding folks that our communities exist and that we have special needs, and then it's people seeing it. So in Atlanta, nobody wanted to talk about domestic violence, and we were these girls with our project, and we were trying to break up families, and that's how we were viewed. But then people started seeing individuals that they knew that were impacted by domestic violence, and they had no idea what to do. And so they had to go to these young girls who they didn't think had any background, who were on their little project, to ask for help. And one of the things that helped is there was an older gentleman in our community who had to help a woman, and he relied on Raksha for help. And as a result, he started our annual fundraiser. And with his support, he's helped get the word out, because an entire community had to see what was going on. I think in involving men, and we're one of the South Asian women's organizations that started involving men very early on, because we had a very open thing that we were going to be here for the entire community. We're in the South. There's no other organizations doing what we do. We're the only one. I mean, for a while, we were the only one in the Southeast. And now, okay, we're the only one in Georgia, but we're the longest running one, and that's been the longest time and most consistently. So we kind of have to keep a holistic framework that we have to be able to do what we need to do for our community and not... it's bad because we can't say no to a lot of things, so we end up doing way more than we need to. But by being there for the community and meeting the community where they're at, and it's different things for different communities, we've been able to kind of get people to see that we need to exist and they need to support us. And a lot of times it's personal experience and them not knowing what to do and having Ruksha come to help them. Or it's their personal experience that will speak to them to have them come to Ruksha just to volunteer. So it's been a space where people can grow and learn more about it. And then I had the advantage of really working in the mainstream victim advocacy. That's where I started. So that helped make it a lot easier for me to kind of bring this to a lot of the mainstream advocacy groups and shelters, because I was already working with them as an intern, or, you know, my first couple of years I worked for the city of Atlanta. So when I started working with Ruksha, it was really easy for me to communicate and bridge those gaps, because I had that background to be able to be in the different communities.
I don't think we are in the mainstream.
No. I mean, I don't want to give you like a disillusion you. I don't think so. So I mean, I guess how has Chai worked towards, you know, in terms of psychologists and social workers, when you saw, I mean, it was compelling when you said, you know, if someone came to you and said, wanted a Muslim therapist or someone who LGBTQ therapist, you're like, I don't really know anybody to refer to.
Right.
What would you do from there?
So some of the things, as I said, I feel we should also work with the mental health community to become more aware of the issues, not just with non-South Asian therapists, but people who are, because there's, you know, just because they're doesn't mean that they're well aware of different issues and different backgrounds. So we also do that. I'm involved with the Asian American Psychological Association, and they have a newly formed division on South Asians. So even just bringing that to the forefront, that there is a division on South Asians, and helping with them learn not just, you know, they're developing their own career and that, but also other of the issues that are happening in the South Asian community, and that they might be disconnected from, so that in their own place, wherever they're working, they can follow up with Ruksha, they can follow up with Satrang, they can just go and be with the people, learn what's going on, so that they become more informed about what's going on. Also here, we're on the Speakers Bureau with SALT, so that when we go out and do workshops with different places, community organizations, we talk about the intersections between domestic violence, hate crimes, and mental health. So that's another way we've kind of like infiltrated the whole idea of mental health, is to just another thing that we talk about within the community. So raising awareness with mainstream organizations, South Asian organizations, and bringing it into the forefront, even in mental health itself as something. Because even when DOSA was formed, I was part of the people making the mission. I mean, it really just wanted to be like an organization for each other, like a professional organization, just to kind of unravel identity, da da da. It's okay if that's a starting point, but come on, if you're going to be helping professionals, help your own community too. I mean, that's kind of my call to action for the group, was that step up. Don't just like sit in an ivory tower or in your office and expect this, you know, them to come to you if they only need it and if they can afford it. Step up and make it accessible and equitable for everybody.
Just to follow up in terms of awareness, can you speak a little specifically? I mean, I think that oftentimes when, you know, I have encountered, you know, South Asian mental health professionals, and, you know, experience has been that they have a very fixed notion of the experiences of South Asians.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's so in terms of, you know, coming up, growing up in a household that dealing with domestic violence and class issues, and then you say, oh, and you're sitting with a South Asian person, it's like, to be honest with you, I'd rather have an African American person or somebody else, because this person assumes a South Asian experience that I don't have. And I'm just wondering, like, specifically in terms of awareness and is that come up, or I mean, or not, or and if they do, how do professionals address this?
One of the tenets within a counseling realm is start where the client's at. So hearing what their story is, hearing what the experiences are.
what, and also just historically, largest number of probably mental health professionals who are of South Asian descent who started were psychiatrists, because historically people came in as physicians, so that was one of the ways that they could have had their training, which is a very medical model, meds management, it's a specific model. What part of it is also getting people who are educated from different perspectives, whether it's social work, whether it's marriage and family therapy counseling, and psychology, and to look at all the other factors that go in. So yes, there could be some assumptions and biases, and actually with one of the local groups, South Asian Mental Health Association, I did do some work with them on unpacking privilege within the South Asian community, and what that, you know, what is the standard in the South Asian community? Most often it's Indian, Hindu speaking, right? I mean, like, if you unpack the what even takes place within our community and what the expectation is, like, I'm from South India, so like the norm for me is not to speak Urdu. Like, I only know Tamil, and I didn't grow up at a time when they also had Hindi spoken. And anyway, in our family, like, they just, like, I know it at like a third grade level. It's not even like I'm proficient in Tamil, so I barely speak English. So in any case, so there's a certain ideal and standard of what we think South Asian is, and I think that's a frustration, because Muslim groups, you know, sometimes come to South Asian events and feel like, well, where's our voice in this? So all these things we have to unpack within even the mental health community about what do we see as who the dominant culture is in South Asia, what are the expectations we have for them, and how do we as people working in the profession unpack our own assumptions and beliefs about people who are coming in and their experiences, and how do we not almost instantly have a judgment piece that has been so ingrained in terms of class dynamics, in terms of what the standard is, and who, all these kind of pieces.
That's great. I want to now focus a little bit on this needs assessment that Satran did, and actually done in collaboration with South Asian Network, which is a South Asian, I think, multi-service issue in California. And so, Akasha, you can talk about, you know, the needs assessment, and particularly why the collaboration with South Asian Network. Why, you know, didn't Satran just do the needs assessment on its own?
Yeah, well, South Asian Network, I guess, would be what we might consider mainstream in terms of the people that they service. Although, you know, I don't know, they're pretty great. But we worked Satrang worked with San, I think particularly, it was the beginning of building coalition and building that collaboration together. That was the first really big thing that we did together. You asked me just before, you're like, I feel like Satrang could have had the capacity, you know, and the know-how and the ability to get this done on its own. Why work with San? And I think, you know, to some extent that's really true. And, you know, in other panels and other times today, people have talked about, you know, that movement of the people and, you know, by the people for the... Now I'm quoting somebody else. But you know what I'm saying, like, yeah. that is really just, that's member-based, so why not keep it that way? But it really was about that collaboration. And San is really well-established in Southern California, is really well respected by the mainstream South Asian population, and has done really tremendous work on a number of other issues. So that collaboration was really really strategic. And they also have a lot of resources as well, in terms of being able to publish it and get it out to have a press release and, you know, get some media there. That was a really big reason for working with them. Along with, I mean, there's kind of that peripheral view of, like, maybe this will give us some kind of credibility, you know, have the potential to have that super straight person hear our message a little better. Super straight wasn't the right term, but, you know.
It's good allies. Good allies.
Further questions on it. Was there sort of training done internally within SAN staff before the assessments, the survey was conducted?
you sort of kind of maybe talk a little bit more in more detail the mechanics of the collaboration, because I think that's really helpful towards moving our next to our conversation about sort of best practices yeah. and collaboration. Because
yeah.
I think we all know that we should collaborate. I'm not sure that we're all so great at collaborating.
Right. Well, San has done. You see the little thing.
Oh, you know what? It's of course I conveniently left my glasses.
Oh,
no, I know. Okay. It's 20 minutes.
So San has done work with the LGBT. Well, yeah, has done work with the LGBT population in the past to a degree, and so that was we knew we had allies there to start with, and I'm pretty sure. I mean, I wasn't involved with Satrang at the time. I was still in Claremont and barely out, but. When the needs assessment was done, so I'm not exactly sure the process, but I'm pretty sure that there was some training done, and really that's the super important starting point, right? Is that it's the first to get that common knowledge and common understanding of, okay, if I'm going to be your ally, I need to be speaking like the correct language, and I need to be able to use. Yeah, to enter this with knowing what I'm talking about, or else I'm just gonna put my foot in my mouth. So yeah.
Right. No, and I mean, I think the report is. I would encourage everyone to read it, because in terms of the methodology, is very important. I mean, I think trainings was done, deliberate effort in terms of thinking about even when you're breaking down to a survey, using sort of a not, because the issue in terms of sexuality, having a confidential survey, but then also realizing you need to have kind of the personal interaction, and so sort of in-person surveys as well, and also kind of reaching out into different spaces, and kind of whatever, what we would call sort of mainstream South Asian spaces to outreach, and sort of doing it almost like in this sort of pairing to create the safety of going out and asking certain questions. And I thought that was, in terms of concrete tools of how do you collaborate, seeing San as sort of a mainstream, primarily maybe seen or perceived as straight identified organization, the strategic reason of partnering around an issue in terms of assessing the needs of the LGBT community, I think is a kind of very powerful tool. And one of the things I wanted to sort of highlight in the report also that was interesting is San was aware of the backlash, because it had developed this reputation and credibility in the community. When they began this report, supposedly they said that, well, why are you working on this issue? This is not an important issue. But really also the importance of organizations that have achieved mainstream status to, have the courage to talk about, issues that often get marginalized, because maybe it's very easy when you come into a position where, and it's happened also with issues around economic justice, the worker centers that we know today came out of internal struggles, South Asian women's organizations. So the work around domestic workers came out of, we know this history with, South Asian women's organization because of inability to address class issues. So Saki Split, where a domestic worker organization under London Worker was the Awaz in New York City, came out of that. And so, there's lessons to be learned from that, and we can sort of prevent those splits. I want to shift now because we have about 15, 20 minutes remaining to kind of go open up to the audience to talk about, we've heard about awareness training, the needs assessment, all these different concrete tools that have been effective in raising some of these issues within however you define the community, whether it's the South Asian community, the larger non-South Asian community. So maybe some of you can share issues that you thought have been marginalized and how you individually, organizationally have addressed it. That's great.
I actually have a question for panelists that I just want to make sure we're addressing. When we talk about margins and centers to offer maybe different vocabulary, mm-hmm. I think what we're really talking about is power and privilege in our society and who has access to power. And then for people who don't, for whatever identity category, what kinds of oppression do they face? Is it a lack of access to services? Is it even facing violence because they don't have privilege?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if we can think of that kind of frame. I'd like to turn the lens back to hear some concrete tools that you've done to address power and privilege dynamics within your organizations a little bit more. I mean, some of you have talked about it, like Rosia, I think you talked about a lot this issue of class, but just what my own work is with young people. And I often think that young people are some of the most silenced, and because they can't, they're not given the space to speak for themselves, but for a couple organizations like DRUM that have youth organizing groups, right? So when we're in a domestic violence group, Aparna, maybe you could talk about, I don't know if you guys are dealing with young people who are directly abused in domestic violence situations at all, having worked in the violence against women movement, that's something I almost never see talked about.
Yeah.
Incest is higher among couples where there is domestic violence, you know, child abuse, directly battering. Akash, if you could talk about young people in South Rome, that would be great. And for all of you, I think the other very vulnerable population becomes this issue of class. So, you know, often I know Salda, the LGBT group in New York, we face a lot of class divides, and it often becomes a space dominated by wealthy gay men, period, full stop, you know, and so I don't know if South Rome has also faced that issue in terms of who can access domestic violence services. If you're a woman from a very working class background who maybe has language barriers and on top of it is unemployed, how do you get, you know, in New York, how do you even get a Metro card to get to a survivors group meeting? So have you faced issues like that at Ruptcha? And I think, Rosie, for you, you've talked a lot about class, but something that I've heard among organizers who work in racial justice or economic justice movements, as someone who does anti-violence work, is this pushback of like, well, healing is a privilege. And you know, you don't understand my members, they can't put food on the table, they don't have a job, so it's really privileged for you to sit there and talk about therapy, they don't have room to do that when they can't even find a meal. So have you come into that pushback from people in social justice movements, and how do you make this kind of healthcare or mental healthcare more accessible? You know, because often if you're undocumented, you don't have insurance to even get that care. So I just, before we like open it broader, I would love to hear answers to those questions.
Okay. Not a question. I'll start again, I guess.
Go for it.
From Rutgers' very beginning, we tried to keep it very open, and we were very privileged to have it. We have a Tracoan base in Atlanta. So one of the things that when we started up, our first set of volunteers included many of us, but also like a number of Tracoan members who got involved with Ruksha and have been involved since our onset. So while they came through our domestic violence training at the same time, they were providing us with training and have been a part of our volunteer training ever since. So that's always been integrated and in a strong relationship. But we have the same issues of like some folks in Dracoan just want it to be a totally social space, and some folks want to do a lot more social justice work. And so sometimes Rush is the realm, and we try to be allies throughout it. Transportation issues, we're in a city where we have very poor transportation. So part of what Ruksha does, when we can and if possible, is we actually meet people if we need to. If they can't get to us because we don't have transportation in the 20-some-odd counties that are considered Metro Atlanta, we will meet individuals. We may do a lot of phone work, or we'll connect them to another organization and provide technical assistance at the same time. There was a question about youth involvement. So one of the pieces, we try to really keep a holistic framework because we are the only organization doing what we do in Georgia. At the same time, while we're doing the support for the women, we also do a therapeutic art support group for the kids who've witnessed violence, so they have a way to express themselves. Now, we're not at a place, because transportation is so poor in Atlanta, to be able to do the stuff that DRUM does, and I wish we did. You know, and I'd love to be able to have more of a space, but we've had a lot of youth that have come through Ruksha, through volunteering with us, and a lot of young women who've been mentored and come on and been in different spaces and doing this work. So, you know, we don't have anything perfect, but we're doing the best we can with what we got, and we try to meet the different needs. And again, it ends up us trying to do way too much sometimes, but we're at least making an effort to try and be there and do meet many of the different needs of the community. And mental health is another piece that we are an organization that does provide mental health services for our community. And I think even from the South Asian Women's Group, we got a little bit of grief for doing that. People would be like, well, what are you saying? You know, and our, you know, why are you doing that? Are you saying that, you know, survivors have mental health issues? And it's like, well, you have a right to heal, and you shouldn't have to pay for that and have to go everywhere, and you have a right to have culturally competent access to healing and support, because nobody should have to go through what they've gone through without some kind of support. So I hope I think I answered the questions as best as I could.
Should I go in order of the questions?
Yeah. I'll go. So what Satrang tries to do is, I'm South Indian too, everybody from the elbow, because that's how we do in the dirty South. But Anyway, nobody understood that. Okay.
No, we understood. No, we understood.
Thanks.
I know. I was going to say the Banglas do the same thing.
We're all about the.
Anyway, but that so the attempt is to include because you know I think part of that is being like pushed out of the API community, pushed out of the LGBT community, pushed out of the South Asian community. And so there's like this desire to include everybody, but we don't necessarily have that capacity. So honestly, the majority of our base is that gay, upper middle class male. Period. I don't know what you just mouthed. North Indian Hindu, older. Okay. Period. So that's the majority of our base, but Satrang is really trying to do more outreach to youth, not even youth yet, but like college age, starting with the college and university outreach, which then also has this other, it's then coupled with education and then the way that education and class can be linked, right? Mm-hmm. So and then also trying to move from events that all have a cost to them to having open events and events that are accessible to everyone. But again, I mean, it's complicated and it's not easy to do. I think Satrang is just this, like, it's just starting to open its eyes to these issues like that. I'm very demonstrative today. So, I mean, yeah, they're very real issues and very real issues that the board is talking about and working on with every event that we do, with every kind of planning that we're working on right now. But we're by no means anywhere near, you know, like actually having a large youth contingent. From my joining the board, I was like the first almost youth, and now there's like 10 maybe who are involved. And that's like in half a year, so. But and I don't hope that answered.
And yeah, there's definitely how we've worked with a lot of domestic violence organizations, and absolutely, if there's an immediate need that needs to be taken care of, if there's no food, if they're physically being harmed and need to be in a safe space, that's going to take precedence over, you know, the counseling type session. So I think that there's a continuum of how we can come into it and help working with each other to educate each other to get the client in the safest space, ready, and then to a point to envision another future beyond being someone who's been a survivor is also the other piece of it. And also, along with that, looking at the inequities, well, if they don't have health insurance, if they are undocumented, where can they go for services? So part of that, like the Muslim Community Center Health Clinic, and making sure that mental health services are offered there, and then at Hopkins at the other end of Baltimore, working with the Indo-American Psychiatric Association so that they opened up office hours there, that they had a couple hours a month available for South Asians to go to. Are they great systems? No, because the transportation can still be an issue. So it's not a perfect system, and we definitely have started making some steps in there. So again, looking at it from several ways, working with different organizations, people who can also, because we can't provide, I mean, honestly, all of us are volunteer, including myself. I work full-time for the school system, so I can maybe address some things with the students at another end, especially in terms of bullying and violence and things like that, but it's just taking those things and putting it out so that we can all literally work together to create a better, not just the community for South Asians, but for everyone, honestly. I mean, this mm-hmm. is what we're working towards. This, our voices have been silenced and quiet for so long, so we're putting it out there, but it really is going to benefit all of us as a whole, and that's the future that we want to create.
I wanted to take some more questions or comments. Yeah.
I'm from Michigan, and we have an organization by name of Michigan Family Services, My Family Services. And because we address issues for the families, we have domestic violence issues as well as the depression issues. And of course, Aparna alluded quite a bit. I think what we found that the domestic violence is very grossly misunderstood by definition, because it's not the physical violence alone, but the mental, emotional, and the verbal abuse, which is more traumatic at times. Mm-hmm. And what we did, we worked with the University of Michigan Sociology Department. They had a lot of research, and they had the Shanti Project, which is violence among the Indians and Gujarati community. That was the research done.
Oh, yeah.
And what we do now is we have a training to make our community aware that how the domestic violence can be addressed, and especially emotional, physical part is a separate issue, but emotional and other sides of domestic violence, which again relates to the mental issues as well. And I think our training, the way we do among the community members, we invite our friends, acquaintances, and let them know how the conversation, we show the clips from movie Chalte Chalte or whatever, as to how the domestic abuse takes place. So, long story short, we found that among the Asian crowd, because as we grew up, we saw our mother taking, our parents taking the kind of values, you know, our father came and did whatever we did, and as we grow up, we say it's just natural, it's not an abuse anymore. And I think now our this younger generation has a distinction, but the one which is the first generation still doesn't think that this is an abuse or violence kind of thing.
I just was motioning, we have 5 minutes remaining, and we just are getting good. So I wanted to ask the audience's indulgence, could we extend just for maybe 5 more minutes, at least to get at least 10 more minutes of good discussion? Is that okay? So anyone else want to continue in terms of share their own experiences from someone who maybe hasn't spoken?
Okay. And in New Jersey, and you know, for those who did, we're also a violence and women organization. And are certainly addressing something she brought up, which is the you know, youth issues, incest issues, which especially will be over women. So violence not just against, you know, married people, mm-hmm. but boyfriends and girlfriends in situations, mm-hmm. which is strange because we're not even allowed to date. So to be in the situation that you're not even supposed to exist in to mm-hmm. begin with is another added issue. That is, in a lot of ways, very unique to our community. And also, one thing I think is interesting, at least about an organization like mine, is we're still so grassroots, and we have this ability to take in issues that might not have been either as a parent before, or no one was asked to address before. Because now we're seeing a new generation of young women coming up, which will face different issues than their mothers had faced. And they're not immigrants. They're like maybe me, like you were born here, or one and a half. They've come over earlier on. And one thing Molly has done is we're starting this youth initiative, really trying to reach out to Rutgers University. That is the university that we're closest to, and really going to community events. And we made actually an entire brochure to address things like, are you not allowed to, you feel like you're not allowed to even. Is anybody forcing you into a marriage situation? Even the really hot issues like that, which I feel like has not really been addressed, and that's a very personal thing. And we have gotten calls, and we have worked with young girls who are facing family abuse, not just with a dating partner. So that is something that we are doing. And on top of that, I do want to bring up the topic of incest, which is actually a very, very taboo topic in general, mm-hmm. especially within our communities. And I know personally from my work, it is something I see a lot, and not just with women, especially men, and actually a lot of the abusers who end up abusing these women, they have faced, there's been a lot of incest issues with mothers and things like
yep.
that. And it's not really sick, but I mean, might as well.
Oh, it's true. No,
it's happening. It's really happening, and it's completely not being addressed or even thought about. Like, it's completely blocked out. And I think the issues of incest that we're seeing, I mean, we don't work with men, we work with women in a lot of things, but it's just, again, reiterating that cycle of violence over and over, these boys who are being, you know, molested or whatever's happening in their mm-hmm. own families that are, it's not even being admitted to, it's only perpetuating violence against their own wives, against their own children, and again, their children are being
And we're seeing the same thing, and actually we did start doing a little bit of kind of advocacy work,
a few years ago, but we don't have the funding anymore. Around, it was called Breaking the Silence, and then it was ACT, right? And some of that stuff is online. I know Grace and Priya.
Grace Poor
was doing some work, and there's some videos talking about child sexual abuse. So, I mean, there is work being done. It's not as well funded, so it's harder to do some of that work. But we are, I think, many of the women's organizations that are addressing domestic violence are seeing the same thing, and the dating violence, and also the forced marriages are stuff that y'all have been providing great technical assistance on to the rest.
It's a new thing.
It's actually been going on for a while. I mean,
but this is more like, for the first time, I think we're really trying, everybody's trying to, like, try to bring it more, you know?
Yeah, because y'all were getting technical assistance on this. I remember calls on some of these issues, like, a few years ago. So, I mean, I just think you're maybe the dating violence is something that is stronger. But I know y'all have been doing forced marriage-related calls and some transnational where daughters being kidnapped, and Narika's was doing some of that as well. So, I mean, there's a lot of stuff that we've been trying to do, but it's just harder to do because the domestic violence need is so huge. But we do integrate some of that in a lot of our work.
We do.
So we're just going to take one more question, and then each of you will have a minute just to do a closing remark. So, yeah, go ahead.
Provoked. No?
Actually, we use a lot of different media things in order to do community discussions. I don't know the one that you talked about, but 15 Park Avenue is one that talked about schizophrenia. That was pretty effective. And it hit maybe a different audience because it was an Indian film, but it wasn't like it was more of an independent film. But we got Kokana Sen Sharma, who's the actress, to come and speak, and we actually did a whole kind of thing on it. And also, like, using comedians to bring up different topics that are usually taboo has been effective because people come out for entertainment. So when we do something that ties in a movie, a film, something video, but then afterwards hold a community discussion, most people tend to stay, especially if you can get one of the actors or actress or director, somebody in there, and that seems to be something that raises some interest, gives it a safe space to talk about the issue. Also, even just using the documentary, The Children We Sacrificed, Grace Poor's documentary on incestuous child sexual abuse, was one that actually brought out a lot of the mental health professionals and more than the community people. But again, it's bringing to the surface some untalked about things. And I would love to know more, because actually I'm not as familiar with more of the Bollywood film. So yes, I would. If there's more, tell me.
I think media is always a great tool, whether it's the sucky video that we use all the time to breakthrough videos that we use to also bring up. Additionally, like, there's another play called 30 Days in September, which deals with incest, that we're actually thinking about putting on, because we figure through plays and stuff like that, that you can really talk about issues like incest and child sexual abuse. So media's always been a great way to get the word out, whether it's through PSAs or I guess in Facebook, I'm going to consider media. YouTube is a great way to get the word out, and I think it's a safe way to really bring up the topic where people don't feel like, well, I'm going to be identified if I go and show up, and why would I be here? So using the arts as a way to really get the issues is a safer way to get it out, but then following it up with opportunity and resources for individuals afterwards, I think is a great way to kind of bring it into, to demarginalize it, I guess, a little bit more.
I think my response is a little bit different, and I think probably because the issue is a little bit different, because this is, I think with sexual orientation and gender identity, it kind of gets into an issue, a question of representation, and so on the one hand, yes, obviously it's always better to have more representations and to have some kind of visible something there that's helpful, but on the other hand, one representation then becomes the caricature and can become the caricature, right? So it's this need for a diversity, you know, you know, that all of these different faces that are queer faces to be there. So I don't know. I don't know if that really. Okay,
yeah,
done. Good.
Yeah. Maybe we do have to wrap up because I think we've gone past the promise of 5 minutes. But if each panel is sort of closing remarks and just a minute quickly in terms of, you know, maybe, you know.
Call to action.
Call to action. Collaborate if you want to do holistic stuff. While you can't do it all, collaborate. Like, I want you solidarity to come to the South. So bring it down one day, and I'll be really happy. But yeah, collaboration so you can expand how you reach to your communities, and that making sure it's very holistic.
Collaborate also, you know, bringing whatever your strengths, interests that are to the people, and working together to really reach out to the community. I think everyone has so many special things, ideas that they want to bring, and just formulating that. That's how a lot of things evolve.
Well, I'm not fully sure who's in the audience, but I think that it's that, so there, you know, there are different, like, national level things that are pretty, I mean, it's still collaborate, but there, to be specific, there are, you know, there's National Coming Out Day, there's Day of Silence, there's Transgender Day of Remembrance, there are these national and international observances that happen every year that are perfect to kind of initiate that. If you're, you know, if you're working with an organization that does anything, and you want to incorporate LGBT issues, that's a perfect time to use as either to collaborate with another with a South Asian LGBT organization if that exists locally or internationally or, you know, nationally, whatever, to collaborate with a non-South Asian LGBT organization, to bring in education for your staff or for your group, so that it's that in to know what that is. But yeah, so those are a good place to start. And then it can get much deeper from there, because that's a simple way to get the common language and to do something that's visible.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely collaborate. And I think one thing I do want to mention is also to have courage. I think that, you know, each of us that may enter into spaces and where we sort of look around and we see certain issues or that are not representative voices, or that we take the courage and not feel afraid, because, you know, if I raise this issue, then I'm going to sort of, if I bring up mental health issues or I bring up issues about sexual orientation, I'm going to be identified as such and I'm going to be stigmatized or I'm not going to be heard, especially if you're representing in terms of the model that sort of that Mitha sort of suggested in terms of power of privilege. When you do occupy a privileged identity in a particular space and context, and we of course change that depending, that we sort of have the courage to speak up and speak out, and not just to speak and just stand there, but to act as well, and to take really sort of concrete actions and be involved and active in these issues. And the last point I just wanted to mention, and it struck me when the gentleman talked about violence and not just being about physical. And, you know, we talk about violence only in the context of domestic violence issues or, you know, but, you know, we live in a society that's very violent, violent towards working people and low-income people and people who are struggling, violence against activists and people who want to speak out. In so many levels, this is, so it's not the sort of physical violence. No one's coming and necessarily beating us, but their ideas and that we represent are being beat up, literally and figuratively. And so, you know, I think, even though we talked about these issues in their, you know, individual sense of mental health issues and domestic violence, but as activists and social justice folks, you know, working together, you know, I think that that's something we should kind of keep in mind, that we're really all victim of sort of the violence in terms of not physically, but the way in which the ideology is created that silences us, and so we need to speak up. So I just want to sort of offer that out so that we don't feel necessarily that, well, that's not happening to me, and therefore I'm not going to speak up. So be courageous, and thank you for your patience. And also your gift of suggestions and thoughts for the panel.